Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tax cuts, unemployment benefits, the START ratification, the DREAM Act. What will and won't get done during this lame duck congressional session? We've invited NPR's own political junkie, political editor Ken Rudin, to keep us posted during the lame duck session of 2010. Ken, welcome to the show. Glad you could accept our invitation.
Thank you for inviting me.
Very, very busy this week, yes or no?
Well, yes, but the biggest thing that seems to be happening is the reaction to the deal, apparently the deal made yesterday between President Obama and congressional Republicans. And I say apparent deal because the Democrats, congressional Democrats, have yet to sign off on it, and they're pretty livid.
Let's hear President Obama, what he has to say to his critics. He met with the media last night to announce a deal he reached with the Republicans. The president says he had to compromise.
So sympathetic as I am to those who prefer a fight over compromise, as much as the political wisdom may dictate fighting over solving problems, it would be the wrong thing to do. The American people didn't send us here to wage symbolic battles or win symbolic victories. They would much rather have the comfort of knowing that when they open their first paycheck on January of 2011, it won't be smaller than it was before, all because Washington decided they preferred to have a fight and failed to act.
And, of course, those who don't have a paycheck to open at least get their unemployment benefits extended if they are lucky enough to be among those who do. He decided to go this route. What are they saying? There's been a lot of criticism.
Well, yes. First of all, a lot of the criticism is directed at President Obama's initial long-time campaign promises, saying that he would never sign off on extending the tax cut for the rich, as the Democrats like to say. But, you know, we keep saying, Americans keep saying, voters keep saying that they're tired of the gridlock in Washington. They want things to get accomplished. They want compromise. They want reaching across party lines. And yet, so that's exactly what President Obama and the congressional Republicans did yesterday. But if you read, you know, the liberal blogosphere, if you read like the Paul Krugmans of the world and the Frank Richards of the world, of the New York Times and others like that, they say that it's a complete sellout, it's a cave, and it's a violation of liberal principles. So you can't have it both ways. You either have to give and take to get things done in Washington, or you could stand on principles, stand on ideological purity and get nothing done. And that's what President Obama talked about yesterday.
But people would say he gave everything and got very little. I mean, the Republicans would have been horribly damaged if they hadn't have put through the unemployment extension.
Well, yes and no. I mean, that would be probably my thought, too, that this is a very untenable argument for the Republicans to make, that here we are, you know, using this kind of rhetoric, here we are trying to give millionaires a tax break, whereas the people who have unemployment insurance, we're cutting them off and we're not extended. I would think that's not a winning argument. But if this argument was so detrimental and damaging to the Republican Party, they wouldn't have done as well as they did this year, because this is what the Republicans have been saying all year long.
My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie and political editor. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're on Facebook as well if you'd like to go there. What do you think about the compromise? Was it a compromise or was it a sellout? 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. Let's hear from President Obama again, this time on some of the details of the compromise. He says he has no doubt that everyone will find something in this compromise that they don't like.
In fact, there are things in here that I don't like, namely the extension of the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans and the wealthiest estates. But these tax cuts will expire in 2 years, and I'm confident that as we make tough choices about bringing our deficit down, as I engage in a conversation with the American people about the hard choices we're going to have to make to secure our future and our children's future and our grandchildren's future, it will become apparent that we cannot afford to extend those tax cuts any longer. As for now, I believe this bipartisan plan is the right thing to do.
So he's kind of drawing the line in the sand. 2 years from now, no such luck getting this passed again. But if it indeed goes this, it does this time around. But what are some of the highlights of the deal, Ken?
Well, before I get to that, I mean, you say he drew a line in the sand for 2012, but a lot of people thought he drew a line in the sand for 2010.
For what it's worth.
Exactly, and he ran on it in 2008, but, I mean, the argument was also against him, and the argument seemed to, that carried the day was that given this the perilous state of the U.S. economy, raising taxes and basically by ending the Bush era tax cuts, that and it would affect raise taxes by raising taxes. That's not something you do in, you know, in given the state of the economy. So he was kind of like boxed into a corner. What this does, what the president gets, what the Democrats get if this deal goes through, is a 13-month extension of unemployment benefits. This is for millions of Americans whose unemployment benefits ran out. I guess last week, the week before was the deadline. Was the end of the extension. And, of course, you know, with people trying to make ends meet, let alone trying to get Christmas gifts, let alone trying to, you know, pay their rent and their bills, this is a major a step of, in that direction. So the Democrats did get that. They also got a reduction in Social Security taxes that saves a couple of billion dollars. But for the most part, This is all about the Bush-era tax cuts, not only those making $250,000, not only on income under $250,000, which is what the Democrats wanted to limit it to, but for incomes over $250,000 as well, which is what the Republicans insisted on. And Mitch McConnell and John Boehner, the respective Republican leaders in the Congress, said that no deal, nothing is going to get done, not the START treaty, not don't ask, don't tell, not anything else will get done until we resolve this tax issue. And that apparently has been done.
So it's been resolved. When do they actually vote on it?
Well, they can't vote on it until they know that they have the votes. And that's the problem. Vice President Biden is going up to the Senate this afternoon to meet with Democrats. And, you know, we've seen the op-eds from the liberal folks, but we haven't seen a really rank-and-file reaction. Mm-hmm. And I did see a comment by Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, the senator from Vermont independent, who said that he will do everything he can to filibuster this, to make sure there are not 60 votes to make this happen. We saw Dick Durbin, the deputy assistant, the whip, the Senate Democratic whip, on Face the Nation over the weekend, mm-hmm. saying it's regrettable, it's unconscionable, but, you know, we just didn't have the votes. But the question is whether the Democrats do have enough votes to make this happen and make this pass, and that's why Biden is going up to the Hill today. But until then, we don't really know when a vote is going to be taken.
Caller from Worthington, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. It's about time we turn back this imbalance in our taxation, and it's very disappointing to me that our president doesn't have enough chutzpah to push back this Republican assault on the class by supporting their tax cuts for the rich, as you know, since Reagan times, the gap has been growing alarmingly between have-nots, and the tax burden has been terribly shifted toward the middle and lower income, while the very top rich has been escaping their responsibilities. It's about time we push back this war against the working families by the Republican administrations and Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And I am so disappointed that our president doesn't see the far-reaching impact of what he is compromising. You cannot compromise any further. There are, even in my middle-class suburban community, poverty rate increased from less than 10% to 22% according to school district mm-hmm. statistics. And I think that it's about time Democrats all get together, push back, and as much as we can to protect our middle class and the working families.
Okay. That's what people thought they were doing them when they elected Barack Obama, right, Ken?
Yes, and that's not what they thought was happening when they elected a Republican Congress in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a noise on your part or my part? Or do you hear that loud sound?
No, I do not hear it.
Okay, it's gone now. Two things. I mean, she makes some good points. She said, first of all, she said, it's time for Democrats to get together, get their act together. Well, they should have gotten their act together. They shouldn't have waited until after the election to decide what to do with this. They had many more votes in 2009 and early 2010 than they do now, and certainly after the debacle, the Democratic debacle of November 2nd. So many people say that, yeah, it's one thing to blame President Obama, but where were the congressional Democrats when they had all these votes, when they could have done something about it, but they didn't? They waited until after the election. Well, after the election, which was such a resounding Republican victory in many places around the country, then, you know, it seems like the tide had turned. Now, as far as whether President Obama, saw the impact, he understands the impact, he does. It was probably the only deal he could have gotten to get unemployment benefits extended. And perhaps maybe, you know, some Democrats are hoping, maybe hope beyond hope, that he will use his pulpit, perhaps at the State of the Union address next month, to say that, look, you know, we had to make this compromise, but if the Republicans think this is the way it's going to be for the next 2 years, they're sadly mistaken. But some Democrats just fear that the president is not up for that kind of fight.
The response from Republicans, they didn't get their indefinite or permanent tax break. It's only for 2 years. But even people, well, we already have one out of the box, good old George Voinovich from Ohio. Senator from Ohio has saying he won't vote for this. Any others?
Well, I have not seen it yet. Of course, Voinovich is one of the old-time conservatives who really, you know, is the kind of people who just hate to see what's going on with the debt. I mean, the odd thing is that the Republicans battled against extending unemployment insurance for so long because there was no way to pay for this. But this Bush-era tax cut is $900 billion to the deficit, almost $1 trillion, and nothing is paying for that. So, you know, I think Voinovich is one of those old-time Republicans to say this is just not what our Republican philosophy is based on. Unfortunately, for people who think like Voinovich, Voinovich is one of those senators who are leaving. Mm-hmm. He'll be out of a job come January 5th. And, you know, he's being, although Rob Portman, I suspect, is kind of like that, too. He's kind of a moderate conservative who cares about deficits and things like that. But for the most part, the new Congress, the new Republicans in Congress are really far more conservative than Portman or Voinovich.
We're going to take a quick break. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and political junkie. If you have a question or comment for him, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll get to those emails and those calls when we return on All Sides and WOSU 820 NPR News.
On your drive home, get local updates with the award-winning WOSU News Team.
Agencies that help the poor and people with disabilities are likely to see their state aid reduced. Nonprofits like food banks and social service groups often are the first places people turn.
It's maintaining the resources that they're giving us for food, not for our operations or anything else. This is about a lot of food that people would need.
Hear the latest in local and national news with All Things Considered on WOSU 89.7 FM.
And good morning. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. It's 20 degrees in downtown Columbus. Snow flurries today, cloudy skies, and a high of 23. Cloudy tonight and a chilly night, a low right around 15 degrees. Mostly cloudy for Wednesday, another cold one with a high only reaching 24. And a low of 13 degrees expected Wednesday night. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. Our guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, and you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from Hal. He writes, Ken, aren't the three branches of government insane? We have a deeper debt than Ireland. Basically, the U.S. military empire of living off the rest of the world is collapsing, isn't it? Shouldn't we be confronting austerity, especially at the military-industrial so-called security level, and raise tax money to concentrate on feeding, housing, and educating our own children at the local level?
Well, I think that's basically what the Debt Commission, headed by Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, tried to accomplish last week. They failed in their task, obviously, what they wanted. They said, look, I mean, I don't know about the exact language that Hal is using, and it certainly is colorful, but they know that there's a financial calamity approaching, if not already here, and the way out is to both raise taxes and cut spending. The problem is that many elected officials were on that 18-member commission panel, and if you're elected, you know, you obviously, if you're an elected official, you have a philosophy that you agree with and want to get reelected on. So for the most part, Republicans, the thought of supporting tax increases are just abhorrent for the Republicans, and most of them are against it. The thought of cutting programs and cutting spending is abhorrent for many Democrats. So that's why they couldn't get the 14 votes they needed. But there was some movement here. We saw that the commission got 11 votes, which is a majority, and included people like Judd Gregg, who's a conservative Republican, Dick Durbin, who's a liberal Democrat, and they say, look, philosophy is great and ideology is great and principles are great, but when the country is going into this just really this financial chasm, maybe you just have to rethink some of your old philosophies. And so perhaps, you know, even though nothing was accomplished by this debt commission, some change is on the way. I mean, sometimes you think that the only time anything ever happens in this country is when something calamitous happens, like the Depression or 9/11, mm-hmm. or something horrific like that, or civil rights, you know, some ugly civil rights event in the South that realizes that people need a Civil Rights Act. But for the most part, until we reach that point, and it's very possible we will reach that point, but until then, it's hard to get members of Congress, elected officials, to act.
Harry, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
And Ken, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question has to do with the Bush-era tax cuts. And what I'd like to talk about is the terminology used to describe it. The way the whole thing was described was, if you make less than $250,000 a year, your taxes will not increase. If you make more than $250,000 a year, your taxes will increase. And I think that was very misleading, particularly for low-information voters. I think a more accurate statement, and the one the Democrats should have led with, is everyone, regardless of income, gets a tax break on the first $250,000 they make. After that, there is an increase above $250,000, an incremental increase in that top bracket. So I would like your response to how misleading it was and how the Democrats didn't deliver a good message by not simply saying everybody gets a tax break on the first $250,000. After that, there's a tax increase.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, Harry should just, you know, call his Democratic, he should call the White House. Harry is exactly right. That's exactly what the language was. It wasn't that the rich, you know, get an increase and the middle class get a tax cut. Everybody, all incomes up to $250,000 gets a tax cut. It's not that the millionaires don't pay the taxes. Up to $250,000, they do get a tax cut, but incremental increases of income over $250,000 is what is taxed. And I don't know why it just seems like there were so many arguments that could have been made by the majority party in this country, which is the Democratic Party that controlled the White House, the House and Senate, but they seem to be set back on their heels from the beginning this argument started, and we saw it on November 2nd.
Also,
Harry's absolutely right.
They allowed the Republicans to frame the question and just fell into the trap. And there was another trap here, too, where we're talking about $250,000 in income. I think the truth of it is it's $250,000 worth of taxable income after deductions. So the guy who's making $350,000 is paying $3,000 a month in mortgage interest. He gets to take $36,000 right out of his $350,000 before the tax rate is even applied.
I think you're absolutely right. And I just, again, these are kind of the things that, had this argument been made earlier, I don't think the Democrats would have been on the defensive as much as they were, but they just didn't seem to have. I mean, the irony is that when you think of President Obama in the 2008 campaign, one of the reasons he got elected, other than the fact that the economy was in the toilet and everybody hated President Bush and the wars were terrible and Katrina and Iran and all that stuff. But besides that, you think that, you know, the things would be going their way and the argument would be heading their way. And yet they just didn't make the argument. Obama was such a good communicator in 2008 to talk about all that was wrong. But I guess as we learned, it's much easier to be a campaigner than it is to be a governor. And it just seems like that communication skills failed both the president and the Democratic Party.
Harry, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. David, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Your guest has said a couple of times that some of the resistance to the compromise is based on ideological purity. Seems to me that taking the Republicans to the wall and simply letting the tax cuts expire and then negotiating would have been a far tougher position to take, and I think more effective overall because everybody would have been at fault. But at base, I'm beginning to think that this makes Obama look like a weak leader, and that McChrystal's aides, who initially saw him as a weak leader, may be right.
Well, David makes a point that Paul Krugman made in yesterday's New York Times op-ed column, and he said, look, what I would have done is make the Republican, just don't cave, let the tax cuts expire, and then work something out, in the new Congress or something like that. But instead, as Krugman and others saw, that it showed a sign of Obama weakness. Now, again, one person's weakness could be another person's compromise, and another, one person's weakness could be somebody's other person's statesmanship. So there are two sides of the story, but ultimately, I think Obama played the best hand he could, and yet there are many people who just said that, let's call the Republicans bluff, make them, they want to shut down the government. We saw how effective that was with Newt Gingrich in 1995. Let's see if the Republicans can do it again. A lot of people agree with David.
Doesn't look like that he played the best hand that he could, and that's what concerns some of us who are basically tactical moderates.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I mean, I think President Obama is making the argument, and we heard in the clip that Ann played earlier, that this is not the perfect solution for him, but he did the best he could. Now, I agree, and Paul Krugman's column says the same thing, that says, the Democrats had an option, the White House did have an option, calling the bluff, and just see how far the Republicans would take it, but that's not ultimately what happened.
David, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. Robert, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Ken. I appreciate a lot of your commentary, but you seem to imply at the beginning of the show that it's the liberals, it's the progressives that are upset with this, and I'm hearing that constantly on the, on the TV shows, and I just want to emphasize that I'm a middle-of-the-road Democrat. I'm very strong on law and order, but I'm liberal that I don't want to see kids go hungry throughout the country. However, this decision, it's just burning me up. I'm not a liberal, and I just think Obama is choking. I just think he's given away the farm. He's licking the boots of the people who keep kicking him in the teeth, and I just want to emphasize that point, that it is not just the liberal branch of the Democratic Party. There are plenty of us who voted for him in 2008, and like you were implying a minute ago, he did a great PR job back then, and now he's just like his decision with this is going to hurt him as much as George the First's decision, I will not raise taxes. That's going to hurt him in 2012.
George the First, meaning George Bush, of course, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, George G.W. or whatever he
right,
was,
right, right.
But, Barbara's husband. But
the read my lips guy.
Yeah, oh, there you go. Yeah. I would not walk across the street now and vote for Obama. He has disgusted me in the last 6 months, just absolutely disgusted me.
No, Robert, I'm not saying it was only the liberals. I'm just saying that everywhere I looked, there was another liberal commentary by Frank Rich or Robert Kuttner or Krugman, as I mentioned. But I know that a lot of Democrats of all persuasions, certainly moderate, centrist, things like that, who voted for Obama in 2008 are just very, very disappointed. Honestly, I don't even know how Republicans feel. You could make the case that, well, the Republicans got what they wanted. But you can make the case that, well, you know, we still have it's only a 2-year tax extension of the Bush era tax cuts. Initially, it was for 10 years. Now they only got 2 years. And we don't even know if the Republicans are on board. But of the dissatisfaction I've seen out there, it's clearly on the Democratic side of the ledger. And, people who swore up and down, you know, that Barack Obama was you know, the person to save the Democratic Party. And he still may, you know, as Bill Clinton did, he still, you know, Bill Clinton came back from the dead in 1994, 1995 to win re-election in 96. It's very possible and, you know, probably more likely that he will win re-election. But right now, I agree, there's a signal out there that he is dealing from weakness. And the Republicans, you know, obviously know that going into the next Congress.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
You know, I was reading something this morning that the numbers on George W. Bush are going up again, and I wonder how much it might have to do with the fact that there's so much talk about the Bush tax cut. And just in people's minds, it's kind of reinvigorating all of the credit he might have gotten for that some years ago.
Well, you know, if you actually think of the first George Bush, and I'm not saying he was an underrated president, but for all the, you know, the read my lips and the reneging on that read my lips, no new taxes deal, when in 1990 he worked out a compromise with the congressional Democrats and signed off on a tax increase, that's probably what helped defeat him in 1992. That's what brought Pat Buchanan in the race as a challenger. That's probably what brought Ross Perot in the race as an independent. Mm-hmm. But if you think of what happened in September, October, November of 1992, the economy started to improve. It started to get better. Bush the first, as Robert said, King George the first, didn't get that credit, but ultimately perhaps it was working, and just unfortunately for him, the timing was not good enough because it came just as he was about to lose to Bill Clinton.
We have an email from Tom. If you'd like to email us, you can go to allsides@wosu.org. And from Tom, we hear, I don't believe Democrats ever had the quote-unquote majority. We keep saying they did. The Blue Dog Democrats were the holdup, and there were Dinos, Democrats in name only. They voted, however, with the right.
Well, you could make that case that these were not true Democrats. They were very conservative on guns and abortion and social issues. But you could also make the case that if it weren't for these Blue Dog Democrats elected in 2006 and 2008, Nancy Pelosi would never have been Speaker. The Democrats would never have controlled the House. Now, whether they really controlled the House and whether there was a Democratic majority or a conservative majority or a liberal majority. But for one thing, it's definitely true that most of those Blue Dog Democrats are the ones who gave Nancy Pelosi the speakership in 2006 are gone. A lot of them got wiped out on November 2nd for all parts of the country. Most, and basically what's left of the Democratic Party is a very, very liberal Democratic Party, whereas the Republicans, because of victories by the Tea Party, are very, very conservative. So if the two sides, to quote Rodney King, if they didn't get along, you know, in 2009 and 2010, I think 2011 is going to be far more fractious and more antagonistic, given the fact that ideologically the parties are more apart than ever.
John, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Welcome to the show.
Why, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think I kind of agree with two of the prior speakers that spoke with you. I probably have the same tendencies. I would describe myself probably as a walk-away Republican, and I became more of a moderate Democrat because I don't feel welcome in the Republican Party as it's structured. But right now, I have great anger with Obama. It's because he is demonstrating absolutely no leadership. He's a great campaigner, but apparently I don't understand. You punch through this huge medical relief bill, and the end result is you lose your Congress. Ultimately, that became the drumbeat that you heard all across the nation whenever you unfortunately have to listen to some other radio stations. There is a constant drumbeat, a constant anti-Obamaism. There's a constant cry of, you know, socialist, and you start hearing all of this nonsense. And after a while, you know, you never see anybody fight back. There's no concentrated effort. I thought Rahm Emanuel was supposed to be a bare-knuckle fighter. Well, he's turned out to be nothing but an opportunist trying to be the mayor of Chicago. He has no staff that seems to have any type of strength of image that can go out there and challenge some of these ridiculous assertions. And, of course, I must stress, besides the lack of leadership, I do have a question. When is a temporary tax cut ever permanent? This doggone thing will go and expire, what, in 2012?
National election going on.
Who's going to run against
whoever
that?
Ends it will be it'll be an effect, a tax increase.
Sure. So who's going to do that? I'm inclined to think, I wish if I were one of the Democrats that had fallen on my sword for Obama the past several years, I would stand up in the House and say no. And I would let the party of no, the Republicans, who were so very successful at taking control of the House, I would let them suddenly start carrying the water. If they want a tax increase or a tax break, let them propose it. If they want to let unemployment benefits expire, it's on their shoulders. If you want to fund the government, as far as I'm concerned, baby, bring it on. But if I were those Democrats that had suffered, I would strongly oppose this nonsense that's going on right now. And by the way, Ken, explain to me the concept of a Senate. I always thought we had majority rule. It looks like we have supermajority rule. Everybody's afraid to vote on an issue unless you have 60. So if somebody wants to start standing up there and filibustering, let them go to it. So what?
Well, there's nothing that John said that I disagree with at all. If one exactly, that's what's exactly what's happened in the Senate. You need 60 votes to go to the bathroom, basically. Nothing gets accomplished with that 60 votes. And of course, once upon a time, albeit briefly, the Democrats did have 60 votes with Arlen Specter and Al Franken back in 2009. But now in the new Congress, they're going to have 53 votes. And so if very little got accomplished with 59 Democrats, could you imagine how little is going to get accomplished with 53 Democrats? Now, John, you talked about the lack of leadership, disappointment in the Obama administration. Is your disappointment strong enough that you would support a challenge to his renomination in 2012, or is that too draconian?
Oh, that's way beyond the pale. Like you've always lectured, because I do listen to you. Heck, in Washington, a week is a lifetime.
Yeah,
many things will change.
Yeah.
And but have you listened to Obama speak? Well, of course you have. It's like looking at a wooden Indian. The man speaks in three words. Takes a breath. Three words, says something else. Turns, looks to his left, looks to his right. He has absolutely no fire. When he's on the campaign trail, he can excite people, but that's, of course, because you kind of stack all audiences with your followers. But still, you know, what is it? I mean, is he so afraid to mistake?
Bill Clinton was able to do both. He fired them up not only on the campaign trail, but when he was exhorting Congress or trying to get something X, Y, or Z passed. And Obama just seems so, not clinical, but so, you know, the theory always was in 2008, he never wanted to be seen as the angry black male, because that's what the American people didn't want to see, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But he just doesn't even show any emotion and any urgency. And so every time somebody says, well, things will change because Obama's giving a speech or he has a State of the Union speech coming up, but it's always the same. People just walk away at the end of it saying, well, I'm not moved any more by this than I was by the last speech.
John, thanks for your call. Yeah, that is the very first State of the Union he gave. That was the impression, and nothing's changed since then.
No, and every time you say that he's going to give another speech, you say, well, mm-hmm. this will really change things. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, nothing changes. The polls don't even move. All those exhortations about the danger of Republican, you know, returning the Republicans to power in the 2010 elections, that fell on deaf ears.
We're going to have to take a break. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, political editor. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.
For as little as $60 per year, you can support WOSU and get some great benefits, too. With a basic membership, you receive the WOSU member card, good for discounts at more than 200 area restaurants and attractions. You'll also receive a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, and you'll automatically receive our electronic airfare program guide and our e-newsletter. To support the programs you love, sign up for your basic membership for just $60 a year. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides. And we'll hear about women overcoming seemingly insurmountable obstacles to become stronger people. Joining us will be Women on Fire's Debbie Phillips. That is at 11 o'clock on All Sides with Ann Fisher right here on WOSU 820. WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Jingle Mingle. Tonight from 5:30 until 8:30, it's the Jingle Mingle and the Not-So-Silent Silent Auction at Franklin Park Conservatory. Tickets and more information available at columbusmetroclub.org. 20 degrees in downtown Columbus. No flurries today. Cloudy skies, a high of 23. Cloudy skies tonight, a low of 15 degrees. Another cold one tomorrow. Clouds and a high of 24. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. My guest is Ken Rudin of NPR. 614-292-8513 if you'd like to give us a call and chat with Ken. Right now we have Jack holding. Jack, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I disagree with the last caller because I think Obama's a good speaker. I'm one of the folks that stood in line and shook his hand, and I'm not really a follower of his, but I think, especially in the campaign, his speeches obviously motivated a lot of people. In a certain way, though, it makes his fall that much more dramatic because I think he is a gifted orator, yet his political fall has been that much more accentuated by the fact that, in spite of that, his policies have become so unpopular. But here's my question for your guest. I have a theory that Mr. Obama, if is anything, he's not he's a shrewd person. He's not anything, and I think that he's deliberately made a choice to sacrifice economic issues to push the culture war, to reignite the culture war. If you look at the lame duck session, and here's my question, doesn't it seem that he's willing to put issues like having the military for the first time recognize sexual relationships outside of marriage, the DREAM Act and illegal immigration, even the casino gambling bill that Harry Reid has put on the agenda or seeking to put on the agenda, all of those seem to be social cultural issues that Mr. Obama is willing to stake his claim on? That would be my question.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure I agree that it's reigniting a culture war. It seems like there are Democrats in Congress who probably want to push for these issues like repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, although that was indeed an Obama promise or pledge or campaign vow in 08. But for the most part, I think he did campaign and he has governed on how to improve the economy. Now, ultimately, a lot of people say that he may have overreached because of all the programs he did with the bailouts and the health care bill. It ultimately did not create jobs. And if there was one message that came out of 2008 and perhaps 2010 as well, is that people desperately need jobs and that wasn't happening. I don't see him as a culture war kind of president, but there are issues that will ignite the bases of both parties when it comes to, like, you know, things like gay rights and the DREAM Act and things like that. But for the most part, I don't see him as a culture warrior, kind of president.
Jack, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. And Delbert, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. What I wanted to say is that I think it's terrible that President Obama is taking all the blame for everything. But we, the Democrats, at the end of 2008, we had everything. We had an opportunity to pass anything that we wanted to pass, but we went for bipartisanship. And our biggest problem was that the Democrats were so divided among themselves, that they were bickering among themselves instead of getting legislation passed. and you take what Obama has done since he's been in office, everything that he's done has been good for the American people. But the American people are going against things that are good for themselves. You take just last week you had the women on there, and they knew that bill was setting up there in the office, and what did they do? They voted the Republicans in and shot themselves in the foot, and now they don't have equal pay, which the bill was right there for them. And it's the same thing that's been happening in a lot of these situations. And for some underlying reason, people are voting against their own interests, and I'm not understanding it whatsoever, including health care and the women's interests. And they're voting against their own interests. So there's an underlying something that's going on, because the president has done a very good job, and the bills that he has been able to get through are very good for the American people.
Ken?
Well, I'm not sure the president has done a very good job in that he sold what he's trying to sell. I mean, again, there were earlier callers who said that why didn't the president stand up and explain exactly what this Bush-era tax, what the actual language was? Why didn't they explain, try to make the case how failing to increase unemployment insurance benefits, how that's a tenable position for the Republicans? He didn't make that case. But, Delbert, I will agree one thing, that You guys, the Democrats did have everything going in their favor in early 2009. As I said earlier, 59-60 Senate votes. But then you had the bickering among themselves. They had the Joe Liebermans and the Mary Landrews and the Ben Nelsons. They could have had health care a long time earlier in 2009, and then gone on to other parts of the Obama agenda. But there was so much bickering, so much what's in it for me, that by the time they turned around, Scott Brown had won the Ted Kennedy seat in Massachusetts. The magic number 60 was gone, and the Republican ascendancy was on its way. So Democrats, you know, if they could live over the last 2 years, I'm sure they would like to think they could do things differently. But boy, they sure had opportunities that they failed to take advantage of.
Thanks, Delbert, for your call. Steve,
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Ken.
No, I was going to say, well, Delbert was saying something at the end. I want to know what he was saying. I'm sorry.
Oh, I missed it. I cut him off. Steve, you're on the air, though. Quick, before I cut you off.
Oh, okay. Bush cut the taxes when we're in the midst of two wars. I think the Republicans need to admit that that was wrong. And the fact that the corporations last quarter made phenomenal profits, biggest profits ever. We, in the American system, the people are almost in a feudal system. We don't have any means. We're up to the hilt in debt. I don't see where the Republicans get off at trying to cut taxes for the rich when all this is going on.
Well, you make a case that cutting taxes in the middle of two wars is pretty risky, but talk to a lot of Democrats. There are a lot of Democrats who were scared to death of saying, you know, I don't want to be seen as raising taxes. So there are many Democrats in the Senate and the House who really want, would absolutely go along with extending the Bush-era tax cut. So, you know, for all the things that you think the Democratic Party stands for, all we know is that there are more troops in Afghanistan than ever before. Now we're talking about saying that we're probably not going to be out until after 2014. This is not what we were led to believe in 2008. So, you know, for all they think, I'm sorry?
Nope, didn't say anything. Steve?
Listen, Nate, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, Ken.
No, I want to hear what Steve was saying.
Okay, Steve?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, they want to put the burden on the populace, and it's not, you know, we're not making the profits, okay? You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Well, the theory, of course, is that when you have more money in your pocket, you put more money in the economy. I think that's a legitimate argument with extending unemployment benefits, because these folks are going to, you know, put that money in the economy. But ultimately, there are mixed views about whether extending tax cuts for, you know, people with incomes well over $1 million, whether that really benefits, whether it creates more jobs or benefits the economy. That's really not a clear case yet.
Stephen, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Obviously, I had a lot of other topics to talk about today, Ken, and we can move on to some of those. But this issue is really bothering people. I can tell just from, you know, what the phone lines look like.
Well, you know, it is. It's because, again, I mean, it's a simple thing. The president and the Democrats campaigned on the belief that tax cuts. And I'm using the rhetoric here, but with quotation marks, tax cuts for the wealthy were not going to be continued in an Obama administration. And here we are 2 years into the administration, and it looks like they'll be continued for two more years. So there's a lot of disappointment. And as the people said that, you know, even these are not conservatives who are calling and complaining about Obama. These are liberals and moderates who said, look, this is not what I thought I had, you know, what I voted for in 2008. So there's a lot of disappointment out there. But if you have other issues, we can talk about other topics.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk about two other things at least. One is the START Treaty. I read a letter to the editor in the paper today. A woman said, you know, what do they expect? Why would they expect passage now? They're just pulling this out of their hip pocket at the last minute during a lame duck session. That's really not the case. But Colin Powell, who backs President Obama on the START Treaty with Russia, he met with the media last week. He says he fully supports this treaty and hopes the Senate will take up the issue soon. Let's hear.
25 years ago, the Soviet Union and the United States each had an inventory of something like 28,000, 29,000 nuclear weapons. As a result of the arms control process and the end of the Cold War and the change in the world situation, those numbers have been reduced by over 80%, so we're down now under 10,000. As a result of these treaties, we have both benefited, both the Russian Federation now and the United States of America, but the world has benefited by having fewer of these horrible weapons in existence. And we hope that we can continue this process.
Now, from my count, the Obama administration has been working on getting this passed since they signed it, getting it ratified, I should say, since they signed it last spring, but nothing.
Well, you know, I mean, again, everybody kept saying, let's push this off to the lame duck. And, of course, the lame duck, what scared the Democrats is that now they have to get things done in the lame duck because 2011 is far more perilous for them. Right now that there are 58 Democrats and next year they're going to be 53. So if you think of it right now, they need 67 votes to pass this treaty because it's a two-thirds of a majority when you have to do these kind of treaties in the Senate by Senate rules. Mm-hmm. So if all 58 Democrats vote in favor of it, they have to pick up 9 Republican votes. Now, I think they will do it, actually. I don't think there's that much. I think the Republicans, not that they feel like they want to give something back to the Democrats, but I think there are people in the Senate like Voinovich, John McCain, others like that. They say, look, this is something that has to be done. There have been some guarantees made by upgrading our defense systems. Now, when Joe Biden says it's crucial to our national security that we get a pass in the lame duck session, that seems kind of like a little much overkill to me. I mean, why is it crucial now and why wasn't it crucial 6 months ago? And why would it be not unacceptable if they passed it in January or February? The reason is, of course, it's just that they have the votes. They have more votes now than they're going to have for 2 years, and that's why they feel they get it done. But I think it will get done. And I think with the leadership, you know, McCain has been irksome for both sides for many years, but he's taken a strong stand on this, and I kind of think they will pass it this year.
How much of a legacy do you think he's going to have with this don't ask, don't tell? It all seems to be getting pinned on him at this point.
Well, you know, that's what's so strange about it, because from the beginning, John McCain said that, you know, I don't want to vote in the Senate until we hear what the Pentagon has to say. So the Pentagon came out with this long, you know, worked on study that took months. There was a polling. And first of all, I can't believe you poll members of the military. I mean, you don't poll them to say whether you want to go to war or not. I think polling is just kind of ridiculous. But anyway, but it seems like for the most part, most in the military field is not going to be a real shot or hurt against morale. But then McCain is saying, well, you know, I don't buy this poll. I think the poll is, I don't know, maybe too many people on cell phones. I don't know.
It's
I
like mean, a losing politician that says, well, those polls are no good.
Exactly right. But now you see that then the head of the Marine Corps says, well, you know something, I don't think it's the right thing. I suspect that don't ask, don't tell will not be resolved in this lame duck, and it may be another culture war issue going into 2012, but I don't think it's happening this year.
Well, if it doesn't happen this year, then do you think it has much of a chance? Yeah, it could be a culture issue in 2012. It won't happen for the next 2 years.
Not with a 53-47 Senate. No, not at all.
And with the nature of that.
And I kind of think if there was a more of a one-sided view from the Pentagon, maybe it had a shot. But once the commandant of the Marine Corps comes up and says, well, you know, we're kind of squeamish about it, it makes McCain's case all over again. I just think it's, you know, it's just not going to happen anytime soon. But START, I think, does happen.
Let's hear Leslie Rojas of Southern California Public Radio describe what's happening with the newest version of the DREAM Act, which shrinks the pool of people who qualify for that under the eligibility restrictions. And, of course, we're talking about immigration reform, a slice of immigration reform.
It's lengthened the amount of time of conditional legal status. You know, basically you have to have, you know, a good 10 years now of conditional legal status before you can apply for permanent legal status. The idea was that the beneficiaries could go up until age 35, just to grandfather in some of the people that had been in school 10 years ago. Now it's lowered the cutoff date to 30, the cutoff age to 30. So that's what it's done. It's just a more streamlined, more tightened version of the bill that looks like is going to be voted on.
And this is for people who are brought to the United States as young children, and it gives them
by illegal immigrant parents.
Right.
Gives
them an opportunity for legal status.
For legal status, assume that they go to college or they serve in the military. And basically, for the longest time, a lot of people felt that this was more of a political, even though it's certainly important. But Harry Reid wanted to make a statement to Hispanic voters saying that, look, you know, I don't know if the Senate is going to go along with this or not, but I just want to let you know that the Democratic Party cares about the Latino vote. That sounds kind of callous, but I kind of think that nobody felt that this was actually going to pass, and it was more of another thing to just, you know, embarrass the Republicans for.
We only have a few minutes left. What else is on tap? I was reading about how the new Republicans, are wasting no time raising money now. Pay off those debts so they can get ready to run again in 2012.
Yes, you know, and I've seen a lot of stories that said that these are hypocrites, the Republicans who, you know, talk about they don't like the politics as usual, and here they are, as soon as they're elected, they have to raise money. The sad fact about Washington is that's what a member of Congress does. There's no profiles and courage. It's just raising campaign funds to fend off a challenge. And every time you talk about maybe talking to across party lines, then you always have a primary challenge to worry about. So the name of the game is still money. If money was a big issue in 2008, when President Obama spent like $600 million on his campaign, it was dwarfed by what happened in 2010. And unless the Supreme Court changes something, and I doubt that's going to happen, mm-hmm. 2012 is just going to be out of control.
Well, hopefully we'll talk to you more before then. Thanks, Ken Rudin.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, Ken Rudin. That's NPR's political junkie, political editor Ken Rudin joining us. Hopefully we'll hear from him again soon in the new year. It's all the time we have for All Sides on WOSU 820 NPR News.